At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
GDP, Facebook, and $650 baby werewolves. Seriously. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, the 28th of April. Thanks so much for joining us. We got economic news this morning that falls into the not-so-great category. The Commerce Department reports gross domestic product, which is the broadest measure of economic output, rose just 0.5% in the first quarter. That's the worst performance for the economy in 2 years. Now, there's a lot of blame to go around here. Turmoil in global markets, a strong U.S. dollar, which makes our company's exports more expensive, and the crash in oil prices. Turns out there are also some bright spots: housing, construction, government spending. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to sift through all those numbers for us.
If you want to fret over whether the U.S. economy is now sinking towards slow or even no growth, there are several data points here to worry about. Investment by business in new equipment and factories fell nearly 6%, more than any time since the recession ended. Exports down 2.5%. Consumer spending down from 3% last summer to just 1.9% in early 2016. But Paul Ashworth at Capital Economics says conditions have been improving as we head into spring.
We had some headwinds on the economy from the drop in mining investment that was obviously triggered by the very big falls in oil prices last year. That should begin to fade. More recently, the dollar appears to have stabilized, so that contraction in exports should fade in the second half of the year.
Most economists are still predicting growth will pick up to around 2% for all of 2016, which wouldn't be great in historic terms. But, says Greg McBride at Bankrate.com, it's been good enough to keep unemployment falling and job creation humming along.
People do have very high feelings of job security.
But because there's been virtually no increase in wages after accounting for inflation, McBride says American workers are not
seeing enough money in the paycheck to the point where people are comfortable spending. We also see a greater hesitancy toward accumulating debt now relative to, say, 10 years ago prior to the recession.
And lest you take any of this GDP data as a reason to A, hide under a rock and put your money under the mattress, or B, quit your job and splurge on a Caribbean vacation, just remember this is the preliminary GDP report. There'll be two more revisions as more stats flow in. So stay tuned. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Facebook surprised analysts with just how upbeat its earnings were yesterday, and also with a plan to add a new class of stock to the two the company already has, Class C shares, which will allow CEO Mark Zuckerberg to keep his voting power. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
One share, one vote. That's the way it works in most companies when shareholders weigh in on important issues. Companies can, and sometimes do, create a tiered system with higher voting rights for some shares, lower for everyone else. Oliver Hart is an econ professor at Harvard.
It didn't used to be that common, but there were some prominent examples like Ford or the New York Times that did it. They were often family-controlled companies.
Families who wanted to keep that control. Facebook already has this two-tier structure. Now it wants to add a new level, one that has no voting rights. Google already has a similar structure.
It's a new ballgame in a way with these new sorts of companies doing this, and nobody really knows how things are going to look. You know, when the founders get old or less effective.
CEO Mark Zuckerberg says the move will also free him up to donate shares to charity without giving up company control.
If you believe strongly that this founder is a great executive, then this isn't a big deal for you.
Mark Mahaney is an internet analyst with RBC Capital Markets.
However, if you want to be careful and not want to make a 10 to 20 year bet on what can happen to founders and how their interests and their skills can change over time, then this is something of a negative development for you.
Lots of shareholders may not exercise their voting rights anyway, especially when the company is doing well. But Rui Albuquerque with Boston College says it's when things aren't going well that shareholders need a voice.
In bad times, we've seen lots of instances where outside shareholders require companies to do things, either to pay out dividends or don't do a merger or change compensation policies of management, or they'll try to put pressure in some ways to change corporate policies.
The plan has to be approved by Facebook shareholders in June, but we can probably guess how that vote will go. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Volkswagen wants the U.S. to know it's really sorry. The head of the car company says he apologized to President Obama this week for rigged emissions tests. VW has set aside $18 billion to cover lawsuits and vehicle fixes, but says those costs could grow. Even so, the car company thinks it'll be able to cover its bill without selling any of its assets. Volkswagen shares are off 20% since the scandal blew up, but edged up more than 2% today. On Wall Street more broadly, a whole lot of long faces. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Puerto Rico is in a tough spot. The government sold billions of dollars in bonds to balance its budget. And at the end of this week, the island needs to make $422 million in interest payments on those bonds. But the government says it just doesn't have the money. Marketplace's Andy Euler spent a week on the island to get a sense of what the debt crisis looks like and how we got here.
The issue isn't that Puerto Rico's in debt. Virtually every governmental body borrows money by selling bonds. Bonds are basically IOUs. There's a contract that says how much interest will be paid for how many years, and there's a big market for them, especially Puerto Rican bonds. The issue is why investment firms, hedge funds, and banks kept buying them. Kent Hughes is a public policy fellow at the Wilson Center.
I think you look back at our recent experience with subprime mortgages. You have incentives to sell them. You have people who are running mutual funds who have to try to beat the market. That's their incentive, or certainly to have a decent return. And sometimes that clouds people's judgment as to what they're actually buying.
One way to beat the market was to buy Puerto Rico bonds that paid 8% interest and were also tax-free. The problem is that Puerto Rico can't pay the interest. And that wasn't a secret. Puerto Rico's economy has been faltering for at least 10 years. Didn't these fund managers know the island was likely to default?
Well, the answer was they intuitively knew that might happen, but greed is a big driver.
Marilyn Cohen is CEO of Envision Capital Management. She says the Puerto Rican government knew what it was doing.
Last year, when they issued their long-term general obligation bonds and said this is going to be enough to keep us going, you know, that was a big lie. But all of the hedge funds thought, well, they're going to get in while the getting is good, and then they'll just get out when things turn sour.
Puerto Rico essentially can't make a minimum payment on its credit card, and it's applied for a lot of cards. Puerto Rican Senator Ramon Luis Nieves says the government has spent recklessly for at least 20 years, but he says the system enabled the island to keep borrowing. Last time Puerto Rico sold bonds, it sold $3.5 billion worth. Orders for the bonds were almost five times that.
With the help of our good friends from the rating agencies, which did not have any problems with Puerto Rico's borrowing, by 2013... we were on the verge of insolvency, which is the moment that we are right now.
Between now and July, Puerto Rico owes about $3 billion in debt payments that it can't make. A lot of that debt is owned by institutions who are trying to make a killing. Many of those, often called vulture funds, bought in for pennies on the dollar late in the game. Now they want to be made whole. But the biggest losers in this are Puerto Ricans. The island's government promoted funds that only Puerto Ricans who live on the island could invest in. Now they're losing all their money. Karen Pietre works with stockbrokers at Banco Popular, Puerto Rico's biggest bank.
I assisted people crying Most of them are Puerto Ricans, but they invest in Puerto Rico and USA.
Defaulting on these bonds will hurt Puerto Rico's ability to borrow in the future. But Senator Nieves says paying creditors means...
teachers not getting paid, people in the health sector not being able to provide services for the poor, policemen, teachers. We will really be in a position of starting a real conflict, and it will get bloody.
However Puerto Rico gets relief from its debt, whether it's in bankruptcy court or in lawsuits with hedge funds, someone is going to be out some money. Someone beyond the millions of Puerto Ricans on the island who have already lost money and public services. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Andy interviewed Puerto Ricans around the island about how the debt crisis is affecting their lives. Check out the full series, including video of their stories, at marketplace.org. When it comes to health insurance premiums, signs suggest 2017 could be pretty rough, particularly for the 12 million people who buy coverage on the public exchanges. Already, insurers in Virginia have proposed rate hikes from 9 to 37%. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports next year is shaping up to be a big test for both insurers and consumers.
In the small universe that is health insurance, this year should be pretty nice for the men and women who predict how much insurers have to pay out in claims.
Actuaries across the country will be able to sleep better at night for 2017.
John Bertko is chief actuary for the exchange Covered California. He says that's because after 3 years, actuaries finally have enough information to more accurately forecast what they need to make a profit. More sick people than expected and exploding drug prices drive the prediction that most premiums will go up from 5% into the teens. Another reason, though, says the Kaiser Family Foundation's Larry Levitt, is that insurers are losing a $4 billion subsidy called reinsurance. That helps cover the cost for the most expensive consumers.
The reinsurance money has allowed premiums this year in ACA plans to be about 5% lower than they would have been if that subsidy didn't exist.
Higher premiums will certainly mean more tax dollars to help cover the cost of subsidizing coverage. But MIT economist John Gruber says individual consumers might not get whacked as much as you'd think. Gruber says 4 out of 10 people are shopping for the best deals.
What's exciting is people are paying attention. Competition's working. We took a market that was disorganized, where people had no idea what they were buying, where they just stuck with outdated products for many years. And we've put them in an environment where they're taking it seriously.
With so many people hunting around for those good deals, it actually puts pressure on the insurers. John Bertko says insurers, at least in the most competitive places, are fighting for market share.
Once a year, we play musical chairs to get down to the lowest or second lowest cost plan in a region. The plans are all incredibly aware of that and try their hardest.
Bertko says the stakes are high. If an insurer ends up with one of the most competitive bids, they stand to attract some of those people who this year will likely see a sharp premium spike. That is what you call an opportunity. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up,
he is a severed head with a bloody pan, and he's damn handsome.
A look at one slice of the multi-billion dollar scare industry. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 210 points, 1 1/10%, to close at 17,830. The Nasdaq erased 57 points, or 1 1/10%, to finish at 4805. And the S&P 500 dropped 19 points, that's 9/10%, to end the day at 2075. The GDP report we told you about gets most of the credit for the frowns on Wall Street today. In other news, Facebook continued its victory dance after yesterday's killer earnings report. Shares were up 7%. After the bell, LinkedIn delivered a positive quarterly report and connected to a higher stock price. Growing engagement on the site helped push the stock up 15%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.82%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Need your marketplace fix on the go? You can listen anytime, anywhere on your mobile device or online. You can find us on iTunes, Slacker, TuneIn, and more. Or download the Marketplace mobile app and never miss the numbers.
You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. So remember that time when Comcast called reports that it wanted to buy DreamWorks rumors, like yesterday? Well, this morning, the entertainment giant announced plans to buy the animation powerhouse for just under $4 billion. Cynthia Littleton is managing editor for television at Variety. She's been following the story for the last few weeks. Cynthia, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So why does this deal make sense for Comcast now? What's DreamWorks ad?
You know, I mean, DreamWorks is an almost 20-year-old company, and they have a very deep library of content, of characters, just the kind of material that a company like Comcast, with all of its tentacles and theme parks and television, television around the world, even digital media, their presence is growing. DreamWorks is a company with a kind of intellectual property that can be exploited through so many channels that are within Comcast, much more so than DreamWorks Animation, as a relatively small company, could ever do on its own.
And what are the things they could do with those characters? Where might we see these characters pop up in a way that DreamWorks really didn't have access to push them out there?
Well, Comcast, of course, is the parent company of Universal Studios, and Universal Studios has a growing number of theme parks around the world. They have, of course, big installations in Florida, in Hollywood, in Japan. And they are also, they very much have their eye on building a theme park in Beijing. They need the kind of properties that will produce a new movie every couple of years and have TV shows, the kind of things that kids especially can see on one screen and want to relate to live and in the flesh. It's a classic page from the Disney playbook.
DreamWorks has been on the block for a while, so why didn't we see it before now?
I think in the last couple of years, of course, Comcast was a little distracted by a much bigger, much richer acquisition that they pursued, but was stopped by the federal government. They were trying to become even bigger in their core cable business with the purchase of Time Warner Cable. That did not pass muster with federal regulators and was torpedoed last year. This was a company that was poised to do a $50 billion acquisition a little more than a year ago. So buying DreamWorks for just under $4 billion is, you know, it's lunch money comparatively.
I wish I had that kind of lunch money. So what are the next step here? Is there any reason regulators are going to look askance at this deal?
I mean, it would seem really hard for anybody to argue that this deal presented a dangerous amount of concentration.
Do you think this is going to mean fewer animated features in our movie theaters or more animated features?
I think more. I think it's certainly going to rev up. You know, Universal does have a very successful unit that's called Illumination Entertainment that is the home of the Despicable Me and the Minions franchise. But animation movies take a long lead time. There's only so much that one unit can do, and now they are poised to vastly expand their capabilities. So you're certainly likely to see more animation coming out of Comcast, and, you know, Disney may well step up to the challenge and further rev up its slate, and animation is seen as a target for the other studios, so I think it's safe to say that this will further rev up that market.
And what's the future here look like for DreamWorks CEO Jeffrey Katzenberg? Any good gossip out there?
It's a little vague at this point. DreamWorks Animation had some new media investments. It owns something called Awesomeness TV, which is it's big with the kids. On paper, Katzenberg is going to go run that and a few other minority investments. But already people in Hollywood are trying to figure out what Jeffrey's next move is going to be. He's a real kind of, you know, he's a very dynamic guy. He's very entrepreneurial, and he's going to leave this deal very, very, very rich.
Cynthia Littleton is managing editor of television for Variety. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We talked to the CEO of Illumination Entertainment, Chris Meledandri, earlier this year. He's the guy responsible for Despicable Me and its Minion spinoffs. Check it out, along with his story about how he once lost $100 million of Rupert Murdoch's money. That's at marketplace.org. 6 months away from Halloween. And apparently some dedicated fans of the holiday will be celebrating something called Half-Oween this weekend. Yes, that's the day that marks half a year till October 31st. No judgment. As Lisa Napoli reports, the $7.5 billion scare industry is really a year-round thing.
Here among the crowds of freakily dressed people at Monsterpalooza at the Pasadena Convention Center, Yvonne Solomon stands out. Not because of the red dress she's wearing with a plunging neckline. It's the large, old-fashioned baby carriage she's pushing. In it are four distinctive creatures.
These are my werepups. They're silicone, handmade little pieces of art.
Werepups. Baby werewolves. Solomon paid an artist $650 a piece for these creepy-looking critters. At this gathering of fellow monster fans, she's assured a sympathetic reception for her investment. Horror fests like Wizard World and ShudderCon take place every weekend all around the country. People happily fork over pricey admission fees for the chance to mingle with like-minded mutants and monsters.
You're in a big hall with a bunch of other people that you don't have to explain yourself to. We're all from the same mothership that dropped us off in this weird world.
Collector Keith Rainville's slice of this weird world involves turning his passion for vintage Mexican and Japanese horror tchotchkes into a business. He's one of 200 vendors here selling one-of-a-kind pieces, like what Paul Lazo brought from his little shop of collectibles in New York.
He is a severed head with a bloody pan, and he's damn handsome.
Well, maybe he was. You can take him home for $500. $60 is the price tag for a small sculpture of TV character Mama June of Honey Boo Boo, reinvented as a zombie by special effects guy Norman Myers.
I cut her head off, hollowed it out so you could keep pens and sculpting tools in there, and I used actual couscous for the vomit coming out of her mouth.
This wound that I have on my hand here is done with our fresh scab and scratch.
Makeup artist Joe Quartz is manning a huge glass display that resembles the Clinique counter at Macy's until you look closer.
It's a thick paste. You put it on, it dries about 5 minutes, and you have yourself a nice bloody gash.
This snarling, scantily clad woman in a cage is here to promote a new exhibit, Gorlesque. Creator Pete Metzger is hoping to score in a lucrative subset of the Halloween business, the $300 million industry of year-round haunted houses.
We wanted to make our haunt different than everybody else, so we're making it the sexy haunt. Sexy meets scary.
For $35 a ticket, it's a steal. Some high-end haunted houses charge upwards of $85 for the latest in fright. Passively watching horror films, explains fan Sidney Frank, is as outdated as Godzilla.
You can only see the same white, chiseled, jawed guy mow down a bunch of complete strangers in a battlefield so often, and people want a different feeling.
Feeling scared to death, she says, makes you feel so alive, even if it costs you.
You win nothing! It's over!
In Pasadena, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
This final note before we go today. The 100th running of the Indianapolis 500 will have an official poet and poem. The poetry competition, turns out, is a return to an Indy 500 tradition from the 1920s. An Indiana University graduate student, Adam Hinsey, will read his winning poem during qualification weekend. It'll also appear in the program on race day. We called Hinsey up and asked him to read his poem for us. For those who love fast, loud things.
This poem is for the track folk who just love the smell of ethanol, for the carb day cut sleeve sporters, the snake pit dancers, and coke lot campers with bald eagle bandanas. This is an anthem for the hearts that have surged the scope of the pagoda, for the hands that know the feeling of slapping the North Vista tunnel ceiling, for the lips that whisper along with Florence Henderson when she sings yes. This poem is for the 500 fans who love fast, loud things. The hot dog chompers and buttermilk sippers and granddads with ledger pads and suede cases and locked zippers. This is for every kid that stood along the stretch with toes on top of a cooler and their fingers gripping the fence. For the open wheel gearheads, parade wavers, and Legends Day fans. For the moms smeared with baby sunscreen changing diapers in the stands, this poem is for the brickyard pickers, marching band clappers, the bucket drummers, and gasoline alley cats. This is for the pit crews, the announcers, the flyby pilots in the sky. For the girl who'd never seen her dad cry until the day Dan Weldon died. This poem is for the Andy Griffith neighbors, the binocular watchers, and the concession yellers hawking cold brews. This poem is for every shoulder with a Memorial Day tattoo. This is for the drivers willing to go bumper to bumper, for the flag flappers and the earbud and clutched palm fist pumpers. This is your poem, Indianapolis, taking the turn with direct injection. Race fans, thank you for being the sparks that start the engines.
His prize, $1,000 and two tickets to the race. All right, that's all we have time for. Today, the Dow dropped 210 points, 1.1%. The Nasdaq erased 57 points, or 1.1%. And the S&P 500 lost 19 points. That's 0.9%. Golda Arthur, John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Patty Hirsch, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Adrienne Hill. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a good evening. Kai's going to be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.